Hey everybody, Sarah Grillo here, coming at you again with another episode of the Sarah Grillo podcast. There are a variety of reasons that advisors feel like clients just don't get it when it comes to risk. And so I'm going to name a few. Do any of these sound familiar? Clients want high returns, but low risk. They don't fully grasp the concept of risk when talking about interest rate and purchasing power. They have recency bias. They favor the short-term trend and forget to remember that their plan is built for the long term. Other complaints include, I can't get my married clients, the husband and wife, to agree on the same risk tolerance. Clients go by what journalists say and do not think in terms of risk. Over a range of possibilities. They think of it in terms of straight lines. I could go on and on. We covered this in another podcast on this same topic with Riskalyze. But today, I'm really excited because I've got Hugh Massey, founder of DNA Behavior, here to cover for us what are some of the behavioral biases that people have about risk? How is this working in their head cognitively? How do they understand risk? And how should advisors be communicating with them to fix this disconnect? Hugh, great to have you. What's up with DNA Behavior?
Hi, Sarah. I'm really excited to be with you today to discuss this major and challenging but exciting topic.
Yeah. So let's jump right in. The number one frustration that people tend to have, advisors tend to have, is this idea of, I think at the core of it, what does risk really mean? So what can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that's a great question, Sarah, and risk can mean a lot of things. And I think it's a term that in the industry has been misused. I think there's a lot of components to risk. When you really break it down, there's a, what I call a risk need, which is what's the actual financial risk you need to take to achieve your financial goals. That's actually a financial question, not a behavioral one. There's risk capacity, which is more about financial capacity. You know, what's your wealth now, income streams, maybe even future wealth from inheritance or whatever that's driving a financial capacity. And then there's varying layers of behavioral risk from, you know, which is, where DNA Behavior comes in with financial DNA and starts with is what is your natural level of risk? And we talk about that a lot in loss aversion, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But there's also, risk is for many people driven by situational experiences. And then there's just their perceptions of risk. And reality is that advisors and clients have to be able to assimilate all of that and pull it together to come down to, you know, what is the decisions they're going to make about taking risk. But what I think behaviorally, what we have learned now through behavioral science research, and, you know, there's a theory out there called prospect theory that's dealt with this that Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize for. But in simple terms for the audience, people favor certainty far more then they wish to, dabble and take risk, you know, in an uncertain environment. And so I think that's the framework that we need to address this from. And if we distill that down, I think the conversation really should change from risk to loss aversion. And what are the amounts of losses that people can handle? And we see this come out in lots of dimensions that people will take some wins off the table, but they will continue to sit out there with their losses. For example, that's one bias, or that, you know, some people will operate on a one for one basis in terms of when the more aggressive ones on, you know, losses versus gains, and there are others that where really losses absolutely scare them. But I think, Sarah, the conversation should be more about the loss aversion and what level of losses are you prepared to accept and to see that and experience. We don't want people to actually have to experience it, but to see what it means, I think is probably the better conversation.
Right. So how do you go about doing that? How do you find out what loss means to a client and what their level of aversion is?
So in the way we approach it is that we do have clients complete a behaviorally structured psychometric questionnaire. And our particular difference with this over all the risk profiles out there, so it's not really an RTQ in any way. It was designed to uncover how people behave under pressure. So my theory when I came to this, and I came to this world from having a family office style business in Australia and before that a CPA, but what I could see is that people behave differently when they were under pressure. And often that was caused by money and emotional circumstances. So the particular behaviors would magnify under pressure. And loss aversion is one of those. And what I actually wanted to know, Sarah, was how the client's complete financial personality worked, not just the risk, because I saw the risk as only one element. And I think that's part of the problem is that a lot of the risk tolerance questionnaires out there are very singular. They're also very much structured to situational biases. And what I wanted to
Hold on a second. What do you mean by that? Structured towards situational biases.
So the questions could ask, you know, if the market went down 20%, what would you do? And then there's five choices, and you select A, B, C, or D. Or if you lost your job, what would you do? You know, and you've got you get to choose from five selections, or they give you portfolio type. Mm-hmm. Questions, and you've got to make a choice between that. Well, the consumer will change their answers to that depending on the current environment, how they woke up this morning, whether they had a bad day at work yesterday, or they're scared about the future. Their answers to that can change very regularly. And the other problem in there is that do they actually understand the question? And even when I read some of those questions, at times I don't even understand it. They're so complicated, and what is it really meaning? And then it becomes a very subjective choice. So it's a construction of the RTQ that's potentially the biggest problem there, and is causing warped answers. And if that's then what the advisor's having a conversation about, that's a problem. It's not to say those RTQs shouldn't be used, but they are measuring learned behaviours in a current circumstance. That's only one part of who the client is. It's not saying how the client's going to behave when they're under pressure. And that's where DNA behavior went to. And that's why we call our company DNA behavior. We wanted to know firstly how a person would behave under pressure and removing all situational bias. And so our questionnaire that we have people complete that takes about 10 minutes was specifically designed with psychologists to remove those biases to get to the core of how a person will instinctively behave. And we then, you know, have been very successful at getting repeat outcomes over long time periods. You know, so we in fact had people who did the assessment in 2002, 2006, they did it in 2008 through 10, and then later on, and the results come out very consistent. And that's because of how we measure it. So that's the first thing is to get the right starting point and the right measurement up front. And then I think, Sarah, the question becomes is around the conversation with the client needs to address a certain number of issues. One of those is the loss aversion. And we do that with a tool called the Market Mood, where we take their style and we plug that into real-time market movements to see the client's different reactions, and they can be simulated through that conversation, and it will then show them, you know, how they might feel with a market decline of 5% or a market uptick of 5% or worse or better, and that's really our approach to that.
But let's say that, excuse me, I'm sorry, you know, that everyone listening to this probably knows by now that I have like a million children under 4 years old, and so I'm always getting sick in the winter. I'm sorry, everybody. But what if you were to assess their risk or get the right measurement, you say, is step one. Now, I'm sitting there with the client. I have their risk measurement, so to speak. But what if that does not line up with what their risk need is or their risk capacity is, like you explained in the beginning?
Yeah, so that's the... That was going to be my, I wanted to give you a break to ask that question, Sarah.
Wow. See, you interpreted my behavior. How fitting of you.
I'm very intuitive individual, believe it or not.
Right.
So I believe that's where the conversation comes down to with the client is to line up the risk need, look at the risk capacity, and then look at the behavioral risk. And look at those differences, because there are clients out there who have actually a very high capability to take risk or to live with losses behaviorally or emotionally, but they don't need to take risk to achieve their goals. Well, you can dial down the amount of risk that they're going to take. Now, the problem that can come with those clients is that they nevertheless, because they're risk takers, they're always looking for the risk, right? Where are my returns? They will inherently ask that question, but do they need to be? And that's the same if they've got a strong financial capacity. I think the problem becomes for the advisor when you flip it all around, that the client is inherently cautious, got a high loss aversion, and they're a long way from their goals. And what do you do with that? You've got to look at that situation. And you know, one of the things that we've come to with DNA behavior recently, and I've been doing a lot more work on, because really our mantra is the behavioral management of the client at a holistic level, is the client's spending patterns. And so that also has to be introduced to the equation, because if they're cautious with a high loss aversion and they're a long way from their goals, what's their spending patterns? And, you know, at the end of the day, the advisors can't force the clients to do anything. The client's got to live that journey themselves, but maybe changing the spending pattern is part of it, and saving more money becomes part of the equation. But I think it's a gradual, you know, what I would do in sort of our wealth mentoring principles, I would start to dial the client up a little bit on the risk taking, but not completely to the risk need level when they're a long way from achieving their goal. It's got to be a journey. They've got to be educated and learn to experience up and down markets. But I'd also be dealing with their spending patterns. And I think that's an area that we don't talk enough about in the industry directly with the clients. We tend to look at that separately. But that was one of the big things for me in this work, was to understand the full financial personality of the client, so I could understand their spending patterns and behaviorally, because people will always, not tell you completely the full story. They will tell you, yeah, I save money, and you know they're a spender. And once you really get behind their patterns, you can see there's some spending going on somewhere. So that's one area. And I think also people have different level of drive towards goals, inherently, how hard are they prepared to work, push themselves, how challenging a career do they want? You know, we're all, you know, what's our balanced life zone? We're all different on that. And I think that's also got to be understood in addressing this equation. And I think that's where a lot of the conversation with clients needs to be, is really around their goals, the lifestyle they want. And what are they prepared to sacrifice? I think that's the better conversation than just talking about risk.
Well, you made an interesting comment about people's spending patterns not being something that's addressed often along with the conversation about risk. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure why that is not the case, you know, from a research perspective. I think that you can see out there that with some clients that the advisory firm or the bank, the wealth managers can get data on client spending habits and they can see that there, but they find it hard to have the conversation with the client to get them to change the pattern. Many advisors position themselves as an investment manager rather than holistically addressing all of the client's life and financial needs. So the investment manager doesn't really get into the spending pattern side of it as much. They're just more interested in what's there to invest. And they don't want any money taken out, of course, because that limits what they've got to invest. Whereas, you know, the true planner, the goals-based planner should want to address the spending pattern. But I think knowing how to do it is not that easy. And that's where I've been trying to get the advisor to understand whether the client is inherently a spender or not out the gate. And then I think it's about the language that you use with the client. Because if you tell a spender to save, they will never save. But if you tell them they need a spending plan and you build that in, now you've changed the conversation. You know, and so I think a lot of this is, you know, where you started this dialogue today, Sarah, is about changing the conversation. People have biases, you know, and I think in terms of risk, it's better to talk about loss aversion. And I think in terms of the spending, particularly for the spender, if you talk about saving, you're going to turn them off. And I think that's even true with when you talk about risk and loss aversion. Some people, you just need to talk about security, certainty. They're words that resonate to them. So I think understanding the broader personality of the client and their overall set of biases, and then positioning the conversation in relation to that is more important in moving forward. So I've probably given you a big mouthful there, but I hope you sort of we're starting to see now that I think words are important, how it's brought across. And also, you've got to have as the advisor, I think you've got to have the courage to have these conversations. And you've got to be out prepared to go to the hard places. And that's important. And remember out there, a lot of advisors are actually spenders as well. So having that conversation may not necessarily be that easy for them.
So... This is a lot here, but what I'm getting from this is that people hear risk differently.
Yep.
And advisors have to adjust their communication styles based upon this kind of type or this risk measurement and all of the data and information that they should be gathering in the beginning of the conversation or before the conversation even takes place.
Yes, before it takes place. I am a risk taker. Hugh Massey is a risk taker, even though I've got a very introverted demeanor and I'm an entrepreneur. I'm out there in lots of different worlds and businesses. But a lot of people off the bat see me as fairly conservative, whereas I'm actually not. But I'm calculated. And I think that's the piece that for some would be missing, that for some, you know, if an advisor approaches me, they don't get that. But it would be a conversation with me about risk. But if you took my brother, who's a pediatrician and the polar opposite to me, risk would have him jumping out of his brains, right? But if you talked about loss aversion or certainty and guarantees, that's a language he can handle. And right. That's also related to his life.
Yeah.
And they're really, that's so the positioning of the conversation. And in fact, Sarah, it even goes further. It's actually who's having the conversation with the client. Because, you know, one of the other things we do at DNA is we say there is a right advisor for the right client. You know, there's an ideal client for the advisor. I have always been better with entrepreneurial type clients who are prepared to take risks, want to move stuff around, whereas that would scare the living daylights out of other advisors. And so, you know, I think there's the advisor-client matching, and if they will then more naturally use the right words. But if you're not matched up that way with the client, you definitely got to adapt your language out the gate. And the more you know about that before you engage, or in the early part of engagement, the better chance you have. And we'll get to husbands and wives later, because you're going to ask me that question, I'm sure. But I think that part's really important in all of this. Communication.
Yeah, and I like the point about advisor-client matching as well. I work with a lot of firms, and some are, you know, you could say small firms, maybe, you know, 1 to 3 people, and then I've also worked with teams, okay? And then there's sometimes, you know, a lot of times the advisor just works with whoever they can get, you know, the kind of eat what you kill mentality, and that comes from how the industry evolved over time. But yeah. I think that if you're at a bigger firm, I think what bigger firms with more personalities available should maybe be doing is to really start to look at this and say, okay, I mean, and maybe the person doesn't have to give the account up, but maybe they can work jointly with somebody, or there's a way to work that out. Because I've seen, because at the end of the day, if you're not a match for the client, you might get that client and get that money and, you know, get their money and get paid for this. And if you, but it's going to be a limited amount of time, because they're going to leave you, and you may even get sued over it.
Right.
And if you're not the right match.
Right. And I've been a big advocate of teaming. And even if you're the advisor on this, you know, listening to this podcast at some point, and there's only 3 or 4 people in your office, or even 2 people in your office, you know, hopefully one of those people is opposite to you, and they should be sitting in the discovery and review meetings with you. And they should even perhaps be the first person that picks up the phone when a client calls, so that you can even just do the matching at that basic level. You don't need to be the expert to fill the phone calls. Because you just imagine, you know, that Hugh Massey, a hard driving initiator, person who's naturally impatient, and I've got a very gentle type person, feelings-based person, rings up the office and wants to talk to me, and I'm not set for that call. I haven't settled myself. My tone could put them off in a nanosecond without saying anything offensive or doing anything wrong, because I don't give them enough time. I'm not warm enough. I don't ask about their kids or the schooling.
Well, you want to ask them to something like a direct question, and they don't want to have a direct question at them. Yeah.
And so this is really important. And it's also, Sarah, it's really important when the markets go down. And so what's your action plan going to be? And this is where we've been using our market mood tool to help an advisor be able to quickly go through and see for all of their clients, okay, the market's dropped 5% or 8% or whatever it is. Who do we call up, and who's going to call them up, and what are they going to say? You need the script. You need the right person doing it, and in the right setting. And I think this is a really, really important part of the service to get right. It's what you said before. It's the bedside manner. And this is also where the litigation comes. And, you know, the medical industry, there's lots of statistics out there now that 85% of medical litigation comes from poor communication between the physician and the patient, or the patient's family. And that would be true in financial services a lot of the time, other than outright theft. I think this is the area we've got to really drill into ahead of risk itself, because the risk management is actually there in the behavioral management.
So now we're in an interesting place, because you've said all this, okay? But the average advisor sitting out there, let's say that they're not a user of your service at the moment, right? Maybe they have their own ways of doing things, or they're working with another service, or maybe they have nothing in place or whatever. Where do we go from here? Because we've got to get their behavioral biases established, and the risk, the right measurement, right? And understand them cognitively. But then we've also got to put an investment plan together and get a risk tolerance questionnaire together too. So how does that work? Is this kind of behavioral analysis should risk tolerance questionnaires be revised to include these behavioral questions? Should they be done separately? Should they be one or the other?
Yeah,
how do we fit in?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting structural question. So I believe that the starting point is a behavioral assessment that's not situationally biased, like what we deploy in financial DNA as the first step. That's the first step to uncover that information, a holistic picture of the client, not just the risk. The risk would be one of a multitude of dimensions. You want to uncover the goal drive of the client, their emotional intelligence, spending, communication style, information needs and whatnot. Get that. And then have a conversation about it. And that could be done in parallel or as the preceding step to having the risk tolerance questionnaire. So one of the better risk tolerance questionnaires that are out there, there's some that are really good with around 25 questions that are very drilled in on covering the risk tolerance. And you might see some gaps to the behavior because one's more instinctively who the person is, being what we do versus the more the learned behavior. That becomes an interesting conversation. And you know, that's now, okay, that can sound like a lot, but if it's deployed in the right process online and then the results are baked into the planning software and the corporate systems, then all of this can work pretty well. Because what we also don't want is, the information just to sit in the bottom drawer. You've got to keep coming back to it. You've got to use this in the various conversations. And so this is where we've tried to make this very scalable, customizable, easy to use by baking it into, other technology platforms. So that's really where we go here. But you cannot rewrite, Sarah, just to be really clear, you cannot rewrite an existing risk tolerance questionnaire that's situational based to uncover all of these other personality dimensions. Just absolutely psychometrically, that's not going to work. They're too different in their nature.
Right.
That's the.
But sometimes I wonder. I mean, I look at some of these risk tolerance questionnaires, and it's like, I mean, I wonder how useful they really are at all, some of them.
I think that they are, some of them, the better ones, are useful, but only if you've already got the full picture of the client. So, we've got firms that use our system to uncover the full picture of the client, but then they know this is how the client's going to behave over the longer term and who they are and how to relate to them. But they could use one of these risk profile questionnaires as a secondary tool to see, okay, how are they feeling? What's their attitudes about risk in the market right now? And getting a pulse check. Then that's a much safer way to use the risk profile questionnaire. But otherwise, it can be quite dangerous because you're actually relying on the wrong information. Certainly you are, because it's situational. If the client hasn't fully understood it, or that's just their reaction right now, that's not enough.
Right. Well, the other thing is about the RTQ is that a lot of times clients don't really understand that it is the basis for them being able to potentially litigate. It is really the proof that they would have that their risk tolerance was assessed to be a certain thing and then the advisor went against it. You know, like if they assess their risk as an aggressive risk and they filled out the question, right? Like if they're assessed as aggressive because they didn't take the time to fill it out and they weren't careful and they just presented an image that's different from what they really are, and then money is lost based upon that RTQ, there is less of a basis for litigation. But see, clients don't think of it because the way that it's kind of positioned to them is, here's this questionnaire. Because, I mean, who's going to say that as an advisor, right? Make sure you pay attention to what you say, because in case we go to court, this is what we're all going to be referring back to.
Well, I think that the questionnaire should never be relied on. No questionnaire should be relied on 100%. They are an indicator only, and there should be a conversation. If anyone's deploying the questionnaire and then plugging it in some software and then making a client sign the plan up, without a proper conversation and the scenario planning and looking at the risk need, capacity, spending patterns, then they're setting themselves up for trouble. And so I think that the questionnaires have to be used properly in as part of a whole process. And that whole process needs to be documented and needs to be reviewed each time a decision's made.
So what comes to mind now is these robo-advisors, because with these robos, you can fill out the paperwork online. You can there's no conversation with the human being. So, I mean, are robo-advisors, why are they not getting sued right and left? I mean, I guess it's because robos have really only been popular since the last recession. I always say this, we haven't been through 2008 yet.
Yeah, I think that that is a problem for robos, and I'm definitely an advocate of technology plus a human being, and there's got to be both elements there. I think that definitely technology is there to provide higher degrees of scalability, more cues, directing people to certain places, et cetera, et cetera. And also, I think importantly, to allow a greater level of personalization of the financial planning, wealth management process, investing. But I don't necessarily believe that robos do that. And from what I've seen, their process is pretty weak at understanding the risk of the client and the overall broader level of behavior of the client. It's very weak. And I know what some of them do, Sarah, is they shut themselves down as soon as there's any kind of turbulence in the market, they just shut off for a while. Well, I'm not sure that's satisfactory either. And that's probably to protect themselves, but that's fraught with issues in its own right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't see that happening too many times before there start to be major issues with people investing in robos. However, we have not had that in our market environment. People have not had that experience. But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. And certain instances when robos shut down specifically do come to mind. So yeah, that's a landmine, definitely, from a risk perspective.
Yeah, so I think the jury's out. But at the same time, you know, we do need solutions to help middle America. One of the areas we've been doing a lot of work in recent times is the financial wellness space. And we've been helping, you know, firms deliver solutions there. And of course, you do have some employees that don't have a lot of money and they're going through a structured program. But the ones we're working with have at least a call center at the end. And they actually, you know, we've been getting them to work on having the right person on the phone to talk with the client or the customer. So there is a mix there to get, you know, to use technology in the human being. I think it's a hybrid that is going to be the winning formula in the longer run.
So to really have a process be complete, you have to do this behavioral analysis and then you got to do the RTQ. In your experience, Hugh, the advisors that are doing this, I mean, this sounds like a lot of questionnaires and a lot of paperwork in the beginning of the relationship. Is this hard to manage? How do advisors do this without making the client feel like, all right, you know, I signed up for a lot of paperwork here. This is great.
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. And I think you've got to look at, you know, for what we do offer, it's 10 to 12 minutes. Okay. You could say that's a lot of time, but, and then you've got some other activities you need to do. I think it's all about how it's sequenced. It's the bedside manner of it. But clients have also got to look at that in relation to, we're dealing with people's lives here. We're making very long-term decisions. And are you prepared to spend 10 minutes or, you know, in total 30 minutes, time you do some other things to get ready for that experience? And I think that's what's got to be communicated. You know, the value comes from spending some time with it. And I'd look at it the other way. If your clients aren't prepared to spend that kind of time, they're probably not going to be very engaged in your process. And that's a bigger risk. To have disengaged clients or clients not properly engaged, and you talk about litigation, they're the bigger problem. So you know, I think there's got to be a little bit of work on the client. Of course, we don't want too much, but some to you know, to involve them in the process. And it's just a matter of how you sequence that in all of your steps.
Yeah, like if being just being aware of the fact that, okay, you know, as part of my practice, I have to create this client's expectations, being that the client has to know that this is important to get set in the beginning of the relationship, and that this is long term, and has to be able to manage that, because you'll find out right away if the person is going to give you some trouble over that. Like, for example, me, like I'm very patient about things related to my children, but, like, you know, I hate going to, like, the doctor and waiting. You know, I'm ready to walk out of the doctor's office after like half an hour. You know what I'm saying? So I think an advisor would be very frustrated with me, because I, like, for example, I did actually fill out the DNA behavior questionnaire once. And to be honest with you, just because I'm a driver, like, that was what the advisor said, that when I filled it out, he said, you know, you're absolutely, like, the most entrepreneurial and hard driving, like, that you're, like, at the top of the curve, yeah, or whatever it is, right? And I'm like, yeah, but one indication of that was just the fact that the whole time I'm filling out this questionnaire, I'm like, oh man, when's this gonna be over? No offense, but it's just, you know, you can kind of tell what their personality is even from them being asked this task of them.
But I think you have to look at that as to, okay, do you want a tailor-made suit that's going to fit you for life? That's what ultimately your plan's going to be, and what are you prepared to invest to have that? And right, how important is that? and how important is it to have your spouse on board as well? Because how much time do you spend worrying about money? What's your spouse thinking? The issues that come with that, it's hours. Could be hours a day. And so.
But how do you do that? Yeah. Okay. Spouses. That's a good point, because if I had to manage my money in accordance with my man's behaviors towards finance, like, we would be in divorce, you know, like, we would just be like, I'd be telling my kids, like, okay, dad's days are Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I'm all the other, cause we would not be able to work that out. So what do you do when you have one person that's on all the way on one side of the spectrum in terms of a behavior or cognitive biases, and someone who's all the way on the other side, and they're married?
So Sarah, the first thing is, you know, I come at it from the principle of understanding, acceptance, and respect. And if you can just understand and accept and respect who your partner is, and you lay it out on the table, and you can see, you know, the different scores and the different cues there, and you get that aha moment, okay, it's laid out, this is who they naturally are, then the conversation becomes about what are we going to do with that. And for some couples, yep, they decide to manage their money separately. You're a working entrepreneur. I don't know what your husband does, but you know, there's a place where you can come to an agreement on that. But I think what we find is that, having done this with a lot of people now, laying it out on the table objectively, and you get them to have a conversation based on seeing it, there's a whole energy release in a very positive way that now enables a positive conversation. Of course, if somebody's done something to the other that's not good, that's just causes a permanent loss of trust without going through what all those things might be, that's different. You know, you don't solve those problems. But I think laying it out and seeing the differences, and then realizing, okay, what does each need to do to make it work? That's, and it's the conversation. That's what makes this very successful.
Yeah.
And invariably, research shows, women make 70% or more of financial decisions, you know, whether that's what items you have in the house, to where you live, kids schooling, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, in the vanilla situation, you've got to drive it to that. And certainly the mistake that a lot of advisors make is not drawing out the woman and what she needs, and they treat her like a doormat. And in actual fact, she's the power player in the house, just role playing with her husband to let him think that he's the boss. And that's a really dangerous situation. And everybody wakes up 5 years later annoyed. And that's when you get to, you know, the Monday, Wednesday, Friday situation.
Right.
And so you've got to, all of this comes down to, Sarah, the fact you're getting people to do the questionnaire and you're having the conversations is about engaging everybody in the process. And importantly, it's involving the advisor in there because, it's, you know, my other big point here is that the advisor has a risk profile. They have behavioral biases. And the client can eat their style as well. So that all needs to be put out on the table if you're going to be successful with it. And you know, okay, does that involve some time and effort? Absolutely it does. But the reward is much greater. And I think that's what people have got to weigh up.
Yeah, that's a great question. How many advisors actually acknowledge that their own biases that they're bringing to the table are impacting how they see other people's perception of their comfort with risk?
Well, the self-evolved, you know, the more evolved ones, they know that and they will try and work with that, but there'd be a lot out there that ignore it, and particularly if they're trying to sell something, all of that goes out the window and they're just hammering the client. Well, they're the ones that are at risk. They're the ones that really are taking shortcuts. They're the ones that are not putting the client first, not making them go through these processes. Whereas the advisor that's more emotionally intelligent knows, has confidence in who they are and their ability to, you know, to work with different people, facilitate and trust that the outcome will be right in the end, they can do it. They can do all of that. It's not hard for them. And I think that's, you know, that's just the evolutionary journey for the advisor.
Right. Okay. So, Hugh, we're going to wrap here. This has been great. Now, I'm going to get to the wrap up. But before I do that, is there anything that I haven't discussed or asked you that you feel that the advisors listening to this across the world should know about this topic?
Well, I think, Sarah, we've covered a lot of areas. When you think about that, we've talked about risk, maybe reframing risk itself, conversation to use other words. We've talked about spending. We've talked about goals. We've talked about communication, talked about differences between in couples and families and advisors. In my mind, we've pretty much covered the field. We've talked about behavioral biases to some degree. I think what we've done is we've brought out that this is more than just risk itself. So I'm not sure, I'm not sort of sitting here thinking there's something you haven't asked me, because I think we've had a pretty broad, in-depth conversation.
Okay, good. So to wrap it up, let's give the audience three things that they can take away from this, just to maybe summarize or just to give them the maybe three most important points. So what would you say the first one is?
I believe that people should look at the point on certainty and as to, you know, what things do you need certainty in? And versus where can you live with there being movement or uncertainty. And so I think that's one point. I would think about converting the conversation from risk tolerance more to loss aversion. And then in the broader conversation, I would be looking at if I'm the investor, but also the advisor helping the investors, I think it's the spending patterns need to be looked at, because if your spending pattern's high, it's putting more risk pressure on the portfolio. In other words, it's creating a higher risk need, and you may not be able to take that level of risk to achieve the goals. And therefore, it's really a Molotov cocktail situation all around. And then just finally, as an advisor, you've got to learn to communicate on your client's terms. You've got to be able to adapt your style to serve the client on their terms.
Or use a team, because some people might not be able to.
Absolutely. Part of that is using a team.
Yeah. Whether or not they're what member of your firm. I mean, you might have to actually work with another advisor that has their own practice. I know advisors, you know, I, tend to be very competitive and don't want to talk to other advisors. But I mean, but competition can be your best friend in some circumstances, although it's hard to hear. Better than losing the client, better than losing the whole relationship.
Right. And the relationship's going to be lost on communication. And I mean, unless the performance is just outright awful. You know, it's about the relationship.
Yeah. All right, Hugh. Well, this was great. Everybody, Hugh Massey of DNA Behavior, really appreciate you here being with us today, Hugh. And I'm going to leave information about how you can get in touch with Hugh and DNA Behavior in the show notes for the show. Everybody, thank you. Please rate, review, and subscribe to my podcast and tune in for next time. Thanks, everybody. Bye.